Uncertainty isn't just a challenge, it's a call to adapt. At Tagoras, we help organizations navigate disruption with clarity and confidence. Whether it's making smarter decisions about your portfolio, understanding shifting market dynamics, or identifying new opportunities for growth, we bring deep experience in strategy, market assessment, and lifelong learning. If you're looking to build a more resilient, responsive learning business, we're here to help. Learn more at tagoras.com/clarity.
The book Beyond Disruption can help learning businesses think about identifying new products and services to reach more learners, generate more revenue, and have greater impact. And to do that in a way that avoids the disruption of traditional kinds of innovation.
I'm Salisa Steele.
I'm Jeff Cobb, and this is the Leading Learning Podcast.
In our learning business maturity model, strategy is one of the five fundamental domains learning businesses need to work on and work in order to mature and be successful.
And to help in your strategy work, we offer in this episode, number 406, the second half of our audiobook report on Beyond Disruption, Innovate and Achieve Growth Without Displacing Industries, Companies, or Jobs by W. Chan Kim and Renee Moborn.
And as a reminder, in episode 404, we covered the first half, part one of that book, which is titled Non-Disruptive Creation, What It Is and Why It Matters. And you can find a link to that earlier episode in these show notes, which you'll find at leadinglearning.com/episode 406.
And so in this episode, we're going to look at the second half or part two, how to realize non-disruptive creation. So more how-to and practical versus the more conceptual that we covered in the previous episode.
And if you haven't listened to episode 404 yet, we do encourage you to listen to it, but this episode should also stand on its own.
So it can stand on its own, but as a reminder for those who listened to episode 404 already, we should offer a quick recap. And of course, this will be good for those who have not listened to episode 404 already.
So Kim and Moborn argue that non-disruptive creation is a unique form of innovation, and it involves the creation of a brand new market outside or beyond existing boundaries.
And so this is a new term, sort of a new positioning, which is always good for selling books, I'll say, but it's not a new phenomenon.
Yeah, a lot of the examples that we cover in episode 404 go back decades at this point. So definitely not a new phenomenon. But as you said, this is sort of their positioning of it. And that's the basis for this book. And they contrast non-disruptive creation with disruptive creation. And disruptive creation displaces and disrupts, usually at least some, if not potentially close to all of an existing industry. So you have Netflix eating Blockbuster's lunch, for example.
Right. And, you know, for a long time, this was really seen as the way to innovation. And innovation and disruption, you always heard those kind of in the same breath. And it felt really kind of like a zero-sum game. They're winners and they're losers. Basically, if you're innovating, you are disrupting, you're taking some of your competitor's pie.
Now, they also argue, Kim and Moborn, that non-disruptive creation is different than blue ocean strategy, which was really what brought them to the forefront of so many people's attention, certainly brought them to our attention. But blue ocean strategy leads to a blend of disruptive and non-disruptive growth. So usually some displacement happens, but it's less than with disruptive creation. It's kind of a middle path. So we talked about Southwest, for example, in episode 404. You know, it took away some demand from existing airline industry. It also took away some demand from the existing rental car industry. And then it created a little new demand by kind of working across those two existing industries.
And so Blue Ocean is already pointing towards that non-zero sum thinking. It's about expanding that pie to create those blue oceans rather than just taking somebody else's pie.
And then non-disruptive creation and growth, when you're dealing with that kind of innovation, it doesn't involve any significant displacement. And Sesame Street and Post-it notes are examples of non-disruptive creation. And that non-disruptive creation is the focus of Beyond Disruption. And with it, you have positive sum thinking. So instead of zero sum thinking, this is actually really adding to that pie. And it's kind of a win-win rather than a win-lose.
And so to sum up, disruptive creation generates new markets within existing industry boundaries, which creates that disruptive growth. Blue Ocean Strategy creates new markets across existing industry boundaries, producing a mix of disruptive and non-disruptive growth. And then non-disruptive creation creates new markets outside existing industry boundaries and generates mostly non-disruptive growth.
So the three key words there are those prepositions within, across, outside. So for disruption, you're looking within existing boundaries. For Blue Ocean, you're looking across existing boundaries. And then with the non-disruptive creation, you're looking outside of existing industries.
And so in part one, Kim and Melbourne talk about three distinctive characteristics of non-disruptive creation. It can come about, for example, because of a scientific or technology-driven innovation. So think something like Post-it notes, but it doesn't have to. So think about something like Sesame Street, which really wasn't a technology innovation.
They also say that non-disruptive creation is not limited to any specific region or socioeconomic standing. So it can happen in developed markets or in developing or bottom of the pyramid markets. And so you take something like Post-its and Sesame Street, those started in developed economies, but you have Grameen Bank starting in Bangladesh in that bottom of the pyramid type setting.
And then finally, it can be new to the world innovation. So something we just haven't seen before, like Square, the e-commerce tool, or it can simply be new to an area of the world, for example, where it hasn't been there before. When we referenced the machine sold in India to make sanitary pads.
So then in part two of the book, that's kind of the end of our recap and just a reminder of what this non-disruptive creation is all about. But in part two of Beyond Disruption, Kim and Moburn look at how you can find these kinds of innovations, whether they are some of those new to the world or just new to an area, as you were just talking about that distinction there, Jeff. And I would say that a lot of what they suggest in part two of the book boils down to what I think we would call mindset. Organizations that find non-disruptive creation often do so by essentially having a growth mindset, by having a can do, can learn mindset, and really feeling like they're not going to be fixed and limited by current constraints. And so they borrow a distinction from sociology. It's a distinction between structure and agency. And so structure has to do with the environment and the world we experience and our reality. Agency has to do with the power for us to think and act for ourselves, and that influences and maybe even creates our environment. And so Kim and Moburn argue that for a long time, the corporate world has been really urged to analyze what is so that they can then shape their view of what could be. That meaning like they were focusing on structure, really focusing on the reality and the world as it exists. But Kim and Moburn point out that organizations that generate non-disruptive creation tend to actually focus more on agency over structure. So that focus on agency and this idea to think and act leads then to having them question the existing assumptions. It leads to them experimenting. It leads to them reimagining a world without those givens and those limitations of that more structure-driven viewpoint that has, you know, had the stronghold in the corporate world and in just business in general for so long.
And I think it's probably easy to not appreciate or even to dismiss how important that point of view is, because it is true, so much of strategy historically has flowed out of situational analysis. So what is the situation right now? And then what do we change to create a new situation? And I think that even that factors into Blue Ocean Strategy as well. The Blue Ocean Strategy isn't free of that. So really getting yourself in a mindset that's not just about what is, or not dwelling too much on what is, and just trying to get outside of the boundaries entirely, just maybe just completely throw out what is, and imagine just a different world entirely. I mean, you think of the world that we work in where it's just a given that there is continuing education credit, for example. Like, so many organizations operate in that world, and it's just unimaginable to even think that maybe there could not be CE credit and still be a viable learning business, you know. And if it's a good exercise to throw that out the window and say, we don't have that, so what now?
Kim and Mo Bourne also make the point that non-disruptive innovation and growth tends to come from organizations that don't confuse the means with the ends. That is, those organizations don't focus on the discovery or the new technology or the product per se. Instead, they focus on value. And here's just a little quote from Beyond Disruption. They, meaning these organizations creating non-disruptive innovation and growth, they see technology as a great enabler, but realize that value innovation, offering buyers a leap in value, is what ultimately creates a non-disruptive market. So, you know, technology is at the heart of a lot of the non-disruptive innovation cases that they cite, but the key is to not see that technology as the end, but as a means to an end. So the tech is providing a path to providing value. You know, we can take Post-it notes again. You know, that was a technology-driven innovation. It was essentially a failed adhesive, and it was just kind of set aside because until there was a use case that unlocked the value of that discovery, there really wasn't a use for it. But somebody suddenly realized, you know what, actually being able to put something on a page and then remove it later, that's actually pretty useful. So again, the technology didn't necessarily have value until the application was thought of.
Yeah, and I think this focus on value, and we do tend to focus a lot on value at both Leading Learning and Tagoras when we're talking about things like pricing, but also just strategy in general. I think it's when you really forefront what is the value that we can create, that we're trying to create, that is possible, that we've discovered, that maybe nobody else has discovered. When you start focusing on that, that's really what frees you up from being mired in the current situation. You're really focusing on what that value is, how you can achieve that, what makes sense for achieving that value. And you start to get into, you know, areas where nobody else has been thinking before, if you can discover what those new areas of value might be and ways that you can realize that value. I mean, to go back to the continuing education thing, you know, for the most part, nobody really cares if they're getting continuing education credit. They're doing it for some other reason. There's some value that's being created or potentially created for learners in this whole learning business landscape that we work in, live our lives in and day out. And if you spend some time thinking about what is that value, how can value be realized, you start to leave behind all of the old structures and start to think through, what is it that gets us to achieve that value?
At Tagoras, we partner with professional and trade associations, continuing education units, training firms, and other learning businesses to help them to understand market realities and potential, to connect better with existing customers and find new ones, and to make smart investment decisions around product development and portfolio management. Drawing on our expertise in lifelong learning, market assessment, and strategy formulation, we can help you achieve greater reach, revenue, and impact. Learn more at tagoras.com/more. The third point they make around kind of this sort of what I'm going to put under the umbrella of mindset around non-disruptive creation is that the organizations that go down that non-disruptive creation path tend to view creation as more democratic. So, you know, you don't have to be the scientist in a lab having that great breakthrough. You don't have to be an entrepreneur per se. One example that they give is Betty Nesmith Graham, who invented whiteout. She was a secretary and an artist, and she realized that the way painters paint over a canvas to cover up mistakes could actually be applied to the pages she was typing up. She wasn't high up in this bank at all, but she had this insight and her experience, and she was able to create this non-disruptive creation of whiteout.
And fun fact, she was a single mother and her son, Michael, grew up to be in the Monkees. Michael Nesmith, you may recognize the name if you're a fan. Hey, hey, we're the Monkees. Yeah. So that might be my favorite bit of information from this entire episode.
And then, you know, after the mindset, Kim and Moburn get into or try to get into some more specifics about how to identify and pursue a non-disruptive opportunity. And I say try because there are three building blocks for realizing non-disruptive creation are really kind of almost laughably simplistic. The building block one is identify a non-disruptive opportunity. Number two is find a way to unlock the opportunity. And number three is realize the opportunity.
Yeah, I mean, definitely simple or even simplistic, but not easy. You know,
definitely not easy.
I mean, I was talking earlier about you need to see new value, you need to understand value and really align your activities to the creation, the delivery of that value if you want to break outside of current structures. But that's not easy. I mean, occasionally some great new value falls in your lap, like to a certain extent, something like Post-it notes did. You know, you created it for some other reason and then suddenly you have an aha. But oftentimes, I mean, this is why organizations call in consultants. That's why you have retreats. It's why you try to engage in active learning day in and day out, is so that you will have those moments where you have that realization that, hey, there is a huge value opportunity here and we can start to find the ways to unlock it and realize it.
Yeah, no, I think that's a very important and valid point. You know, that what Kim and Moburn are trying to do in the second half is teach you how to go out after these opportunities rather than kind of just sitting and waiting for the aha, you know, the eureka moment to strike. This is more about going out and trying to find these. So they talk about two avenues to non-disruptive opportunities. One is by addressing an existing but unexplored issue or problem. And then the second is by addressing a newly emerging issue or problem. So in terms of that first, addressing an existing but unexplored issue, Kickstarter falls into that category.
Yeah, I mean, for how many eons of people wanting to start a business needed ways to fund that business that were just simply out of reach to most aspiring business owners? I mean, most people can't go out and get loans from a bank. Most people can't go and issue stock and sell it. So what's the answer for, you know, that 99% who can't do those things?
Right. And Kickstarter also had that real focus on creatives as well. Right. So, you know, like really kind of almost micro businesses and almost things that people sometimes don't think of as businesses.
Right.
You want to write that book and be able to put it out there or get that CD out there. Now, in the second category, addressing newly emerging issues or problems, Kim and Moburn talk about Dimche, which is a kitchen kimchi maker that got really popular in Korea. And what was happening is that Koreans traditionally would make their own kimchi. And so they would put all the ingredients in a big clay pot and bury it in the garden. And then they'd have it, you know, over the course of several months. Well, as more and more Koreans moved to the city, they didn't have gardens to bury these clay pots in anymore. You could do it in a refrigerator, but then your whole refrigerator smelled like kimchi. And so that was, and it took up a lot of space in your refrigerator. So this Dimche made a countertop kimchi maker, and it took off. So that's just one example they give of kind of because of this move of the Korean population to the city, that's what sort of created this need. So that was addressing a newly emerging problem. They also talk about the non-disruptive market of cybersecurity. You know, so as the internet grew, as we all began to engage with email and the internet, that opened up the possibility for people to take advantage of us, which then created the opportunity for this cybersecurity market. Businesses working in that industry really are addressing a newly emerging issue or problem.
So those are kind of two avenues or paths to disruptive opportunities: an existing but unexplored issue or problem, or a newly emerging one. And then they also talk about three ways to identify a non-disruptive opportunity, and those include direct experience, empathetic observation, and active scouting.
And so with direct experience, this could be, you know, you're Betty Nesmith Graham and you're thinking about what a pain in the butt it is to retype your pages when you make a mistake and you realize, ah, well, I can use the same logic that I use when I'm painting there. So, you know, can come from your direct hands-on experience. The empathetic observation can be that you're paying close attention to those who are suffering the brunt of whatever the issue or problem is. And then with active scouting, you're going out and asking questions or doing some field work to kind of observe what's happening. And I think all this aligns pretty well to the market insight matrix that we use in our line of work.
I think it does. I think it aligns with kind of our overall approach to market assessment in general. I mean, in the market insight matrix, we divide activities into tracking, to listening, and to asking. Tracking is really kind of observational, just looking at what's happening out there. Listening is a little bit more engaged in conversations that are going on. And then asking is being more directive, actually putting something out there and testing it in the marketplace. And so you get levels of experience out of this. You certainly get the opportunity for empathetic observation. And then, you know, in these more active parts of the insight matrix and of our, you know, market assessment in general, you really are actively scouting and trying to surface what those opportunities are going to be. Where is that value that can be created that's potentially being overlooked?
And we think of ourselves as lifelong learners. I think
a lot of
our listeners think of themselves as lifelong learners. So I think that first point around direct experience, we shouldn't kind of gloss over that. That there's real potential for us to think about in our own learning, where are our pain points? What is it that, you know, gosh, if someone could figure out how to do X, that would make my own learning so much easier, so much better. So yes, you do need to know your audience. You need to do the work to make sure that you're tracking and listening and asking, that you're having the empathetic observation opportunities, that you're doing that active scouting. But also don't forget that you do have direct experience that may be very relevant here.
Definitely. And then, you know, once you do have an opportunity in mind, and again, whether it's to address an existing issue or an emerging new issue, you're going to want to assess it and then really frame that opportunity.
Yeah. And so that first one around assessing the opportunity, I mean, Jeff, that fits just very neatly with the kind of market assessment work we do a lot in our consulting projects. This is about really trying to assess the size of that potential market for whatever product this opportunity is going to lead to.
Yeah, I mean, it's the analytical part of that. You know, we're going out and getting that data from the market, but then what opportunity does it really represent in terms of reach, revenue, impact? Those are the three things we talk about, and those really are the kind of, that's how we characterize opportunities. Is this something that is really going to expand our reach? Is it going to expand our revenue? Is it going to help us to have much more impact than we might otherwise have?
Yeah, and Kim and Moburn actually do talk about, when assessing the opportunity, to not just look at the financial side, but to look at the impact side as well.
Right.
And then on the framing side of things, Kim and Moburn talk about using atomization to make the opportunity seem more manageable and something that could actually maybe be pursued so that folks don't get overwhelmed. So as an example, the Grameen Bank didn't set out to solve extreme poverty across all of Bangladesh. Instead, you know, Yunus started with microloans in one village and then grew from there. So by really focusing at first on the microloans in one village, that allowed him to get alignment around that vision, and it seemed achievable rather than saying we're going to fix poverty.
Right. And so then, kind of to follow their flow, their logic, if you have an opportunity in mind, you've assessed the market potential and then framed that opportunity, then you're ready to really invest the time and energy in trying to unlock that opportunity and realize its potential.
And they say the place to start there is to try to understand why this opportunity has been overlooked or gone unaddressed. And so the key question they would have us ask is, what industry should theoretically address this issue, and why hasn't it done so?
And I think that's an interesting one in our world, because just this week, I actually noted in a post on LinkedIn that Spotify has now entered the course market, lifelong learning. You know, and of course, LinkedIn itself has LinkedIn Learning. I bought Lynda a while back. And so you have asked that question about, you know, who theoretically should address this issue. It may be somebody you haven't really been thinking about. It may be an industry you haven't been thinking about before. And social media has gotten into this. Big tech companies have gotten into this. Now a company that's known as a music distributor has gotten into this. So it can produce some really interesting thinking to consider who else should or could address a particular opportunity.
That is an interesting example, because who should potentially be addressing this? It could point to one of those other players in the third sector. I mean, we like to talk about the third sector of education. That's really the range of folks helping people once they finish their formal education. And so it could be that, you know, an association saying, oh, well, normally that would be a higher ed group doing that and handling that, you know, or it could even be that a second sector player. Maybe it's even something that you expected high schools to address, for example, and now suddenly it needs to be addressed by someone else. I think that's a little bit behind some of the need for the training that happens even as, quote, educated folks join the workforce, where the businesses are finding that they're not really prepared to do the job and ready to do the job. So in some ways, they're sort of backfilling for what might have been an earlier industry's responsibility.
Yeah. And I mean, this is, you know, one of the reasons we see so much potential in digital credentials, which is something we've, you know, talked a lot about recently and are doing a lot of work in that area, because it really seems like an area where the, you know, who should address the issue is a little bit up for grabs. I mean, there's a lot of scrambling in kind of academia, higher education around this, but there are also a lot of nonprofit and for-profit players involved in that. Employers themselves are involved in it. The associations are involved in it, and sort of how that's all going to shape out. I mean, you know, again, to go back to something like LinkedIn, social networks, I mean, a lot of the value in badges, for example, right now is them showing up on LinkedIn profiles. So there's a role, obviously, for that sort of networked players to help create the ecosystem around digital credentials, and which is a very important part of them actually catching on in the end. So again, there's a big opportunity there, and that whole question of who should, who can really address it is very important.
Now, Kim and Mo Byrne also make the point that organizations that are going down this non-disruptive path need both confidence and competence. And on the confidence side, they insist that it has to be the collective confidence. So it has to be organization-wide. It can't just be a leader or kind of somebody who's all gung-ho about this idea, and the rest of the people are thinking, I don't know if this is really going to pan out. So it's that collective confidence across your learning business or organization. And then the second part of that is the competence. And they kind of break competence down into three things. Resourcefulness, which I think is basically the ability to research and to learn new things and to be able to figure out what it is you need to know. The second thing is internal capabilities. This is basically what we refer to as capacity in the learning business maturity model. It's about your existing people and technology in your organization and the knowledge and the skills that those people and that technology provides. And then the third thing is a could mindset instead of a should mindset. And this gets back to opening up possibilities. It kind of puts us into that agency realm rather than that structure realm. So, you know, should often makes people think about, oh, there's a right answer, or I should be doing it this way. Whereas could opens up possibilities and experimentation and brainstorming. And it opens up the possibilities. And then they offer a 2x2 matrix where they kind of put confidence on one axis and competence on the other, and then they divide those into high and low. So if you are in that results in four boxes. If you're in the box where both confidence and competence is high, then that's a green light. That's an idea to pursue. You can kind of go all in on it. If your confidence and the competence are both low, then that's one you shouldn't pursue. And then if it's a mix, basically, if either confidence is low and the other is high, then that's a place where you need to do a little bit of rethinking and recalibrating to see, can you bring up the confidence or the competence to be higher and to make it a sufficiently safe bet to spend more time and energy pursuing whatever that non-disruptive opportunity is.
And I will say, with any business book, if you want consultants to use it, want corporate leaders to use it, as I'm sure Kim and Mo Byrne do with this book, you have to have a 2x2 matrix in it. That's like absolute necessity. And that's probably a good place to kind of cap off our discussion of this book, and we hope the listeners have found it helpful. Obviously, we're just kind of scratching the surface here, and it's a rich text that you should dig into. If you have not actually read Blue Ocean Strategy, which preceded this, you can read them independently, but really, really strongly recommend that you read that as well. Read both of these, mark them up, have some discussion within your organization about them. They're conceptually very powerful, but they're also just both practically very powerful. It's something that I've always liked about Kim and Moburn is they give you these concepts, but they also give you some good tools to apply to kind of bring the concept to life and make them actually usable within your context. And we'll say too, you know, we'd love to hear from you whether this sort of book report has been useful or not. And we'd love recommendations from you if there are other books that you'd like us to do a future book report on. You can always send in comments on the show notes for any episode that we put out there. This one is the same. So at episode 406, leadinglearning.com/episode406, you'll have the opportunity to put comments in, or you can always send us an email at leadinglearning@tagoras.com. The book Beyond Disruption can help learning businesses think about identifying new products and services to reach more learners, generate more revenue, and have greater impact. And to do that in a way that avoids the disruption of traditional kinds of innovation.
At leadinglearning.com/episode406, you'll find show notes, a transcript, and options for subscribing to the podcast. If you haven't yet, please do subscribe.
And we'd be grateful if you would take a minute to rate us on Apple Podcasts or wherever you listen, especially if you enjoy the show. Salise and I personally appreciate reviews and ratings, and they help the show up when others search for content on leading a learning business.
And we hope you'll spread the word about Leading Learning. You can do that in a one-on-one exchange with a colleague, or you can do it through social media. In the show notes at leadinglearning.com/episode406, you'll find links to connect with us on X, LinkedIn, and Facebook.
Thanks again, and see you next time on the Leading Learning Podcast.